Well, I'm not bell hooks. And that's probably a great start, right? My name is Hilda Amelia Margarita Gutierrez Baldoquin. And I'm here to share some Dharma with you. And in the sharing of that Dharma, I'll say a little bit more about who I am. Or say who I think I am at this moment, right? I do like to start with saying all of the names that were given to me because they represent both my mother's people and my father's people. The Hilda was my maternal grandmother. The Margarita was my paternal grandmother. And the Amelia, I hear two stories. I was born in Cuba, and the Catholic tradition, every day of the year is a saint's day. And supposedly the 5th of January, which is my birthday, is El Día de Santa Amelia, Saint Amelia's. But I also later on heard the story that Amelia was the name of a woman my father was in love before he married my mother. I don't know how true that is. If it is true, then, you know, he got by. You know, he got by. I also, and the Gutierrez is my father's lineage, which is pretty common in the Latin America and the Spanish Caribbean, and it comes from the Spanish colonizers, the Gutierrez. And the Baldoquin, I don't know where it comes from. I use it, and I carry it on purpose because my mother said, if you meet a Baldoquin, chances are that you're kinfolk. So the closest I've come to that, to finding kinfolk, I was departing from Newark Airport, like the 6th of January of this year, and an African-American man was there as I checked in. You know, he was outside. And as I handed him my ticket, he goes, Baldoquin? Tú eres Baldoquin? Yo conozco Baldoquin. You know? And he was Afro-Cuban. And I said, you know somebody in Baldoquin? And he said, oh, yes, see, in Havana, my closest buddy's left. His name was Baldoquin. This man, I don't recall his name right now, had only been in the U.S. for about 5 years. So that's the closest, you know, that this man's best friend in Havana, last name was Baldoquin. But before I continue, I would like to start, even though I started, I would like to continue starting. Endless beginnings, right? Before I speak, I like to take refuge in the triple treasures. And I like to do that by chanting the refuges in Pali. And please join me. Buddham saranam gacchami, Dhamman saranam gacchami, Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tudyampi Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Homage to all my ancestors. Homage to Shakyamuni Buddha. Homage to all my teachers and to all of those who have sat here before me. The Indian monk Bodhidharma journeyed to China to teach the Dharma. And the emperor of Liang asked Bodhidharma, who's standing before me? Who's standing before me? Bodhidharma replied, I do not know. I do not know. In Zen, the teaching says that to not know is most intimate. To not know is most intimate. When I first heard that, I first actually didn't hear it. I read it in a book by Robert Akin Roshi, one of the revered teachers in the Zen tradition. I remember reading that, and I felt like I had just taken a long, cool glass of water after being very thirsty. And I say that because part of my conditioning as a woman, as a woman of color, as a Black Latina, as an immigrant, also as a lesbian, as raised working class, monolingual Spanish. So much of my conditioning had been that in order to survive, I had to know. And not just know a little bit. I had to know in capital letters, right? But so much of the knowing was about out there. How I'm going to make it, who's going to get me, if I don't look good enough. And very little of that knowing was about in here. So I guess if I had been asked at that time, just like Bodhidharma was asked, I would have had to say, I do not know. And when I was asked, I actually lied. I made things up. Right? I actually had a teacher in the traditional educational system say to me, When you don't know something, make it up. And it served its purpose. I don't want to underestimate that. It served its purpose. The preciousness is when we are able to tell the difference when it no longer serves our purpose. No longer serves our purpose. And then we're free. All right, the talk is over. Okay. So the not knowing is so intimate, because when we don't know and we allow ourselves that spaciousness, we're allowing whatever arises to just unfold right there. And one thing is to read the teachings and sit in meditation and, you know, wrap our minds around the teaching. The other thing is to actually have it happen to you. So it happened to me this morning. Because when I heard that this African-American Dharma retreat and conference was happening, it was told to me by a friend, Larry Yang, who practices here at Spirit Rock. I said, I'm there, you know, I'm there. And I kept looking at the calendar that said, you know, you got to wait till April to call to get your materials, you know. And it's like, I was ready in February, you know. And when I got the materials, I read over everything, and I thought, I don't know if I belong there. And in that moment, I believe I can honestly say it wasn't coming from, you know, I'm one down position. It was more like an inquiry. You know, do I really belong there? Because although my identity is as a Black Cuban and Afro-Latina, my experience is not the experience of an African-American. Mm-hmm. My cultural experience, my growing up experience, my early wounding, It's different. So I remember asking Marlene, I don't know if Marlene remembers, back at one of the People of Color One Day sitting, if, you know, that I read that this was happening, and Marlene right away said, well, you can come. Yet often when our conditioning is so deep, even when the truth is held before us, it's hard for us to see it. So although Marlene had given me that truth, something in me still said, oh, I don't know if I belong there. No. I don't know if I belong there. So I didn't apply to come. And then when I thought, well, oh, then I heard, this is what's great, you know, in community, you hear all kinds of stuff, right? So someone said to me that there had been discussion at the beginning. I'm telling you, I heard this. I don't know how true it is. Okay. Let me qualify that for the recording, right? that there had been some discussion about the publicity of the retreat to say something like, for people of African descent, right? Or African-American and African descent. So I felt a little better about that. I said, okay. Then when I talked with Ruby, who was the manager, the organizer, she said it's full. You snooze, you lose. You know, that's what they say. And not only was it full, she said there was a long waiting list. I said, doesn't matter, I'll come as a commuter, you know, I'll sleep anywhere. She said, also full for commuters. So I grappled with that and then let it go. And then let it go. So then I, can I talk about, I can talk about this. The email I sent you. You know, chaos theory. You know, some of you might have heard about chaos theory. Something about that is if a butterfly bats her wings on the coast of Brazil, you know, a tornado might happen in mid Texas. Something starts, there's the wave, right? That's, and it's in the universe, that's the essence of it. So my wings flapping was an email that I sent to Brother Ralph Steele, right? Just say, you know, can I come just say hi? And he called me and said, sure, you know, and so I came by today, you know, I think we talked yesterday morning, and I could come either yesterday, I could come any day, yesterday or through, you know, to Tuesday. So I came and brought some green tea. And the rest is the story. You know, here I am talking to you. Right? What happened was that Marlene said, I wasn't even talking to Marlene when she said this. How would you like to give a Dharma talk today? It's Zen Day. Well, I didn't choose Tibetan Day, you know, or Theravadan Day to come say hi to Ralph. So as I sit here, I'm wondering if I'm having some inkling of what Bodhidharma must have felt. When the emperor of Liang asked him, you know, who's standing before me? I do not know. The one thing I think I know is that I'm probably going to do what Suzuki Roshi, who's the founder of my lineage, he used to say, about Dharma talks. He used to say that to give a Dharma talk is to make lots of mistakes. So beforehand, I ask for your forbearance. And as in one of the ceremonies in Zen, there's the Shuso ceremony, which is when you become a head student, or the teacher, your teacher invites you to share the teaching seat. And it culminates in this very formal, ritualistic ceremony, which just about everything about Zen is about formal and ritualistic. It feels, you know, from the outside. Inside, it's a little different. But part of it is that you're in a room like this, and every single person asks you a question. And you have to answer it right there. You know, you meet heart to heart, mind to mind. Yet at the end of that ceremony, when all the questions are asked and you've given the answers and everything is said and done, part of what you then say to your sangha is, wash your ears with soap. Right. Yeah. So I'm forewarning you. Okay? So I've said a little bit about how I came to be here at this moment. I'd like to say a little bit about how I came to practice. I believe I came to practice in my grandmother's bed, Abuela Margot, Daiosho. Daiosho is ancestor, Japanese. When I was probably around 4 or 5, and my sister was about 3 or 4, and we were living in a small town in Cuba, in Las Tunas. And my grandmother was a woman who at the age of 7 lost her mother, and whose father didn't claim her. And just in the last 10 years, I've gone back to Cuba several times. My mother still lives there. She never left. So in 40 years, I've seen her 3 times. And now I asked her a lot of questions about my lineage. So I'm able to trace on my mother's side all the women to 5 generations. And all the women were common law wives. There were dark-skinned women who were common law wives of white men. So the children didn't carry the name, the mother's name, or they carry the mother's name, not the father's name. That's another legacy of the colonization, of the oppression. So my grandmother only carried her mother's name, last name, Vasquez. And I didn't plan on talking this much about her, but I guess I'm talking about her because she probably had a lot to do with why I'm sitting here today. Right? So she was someone who, at the age of 7, lost her mother and then went to work as a maid, as a servant, in a home, as a 7-year-old, and grew up there until she was 18, and then married my grandfather. And she always spoke kindly of this family. Now, she would tell me the stories when I was already what I thought was hip, you know, to like liberation issues. And it's like, how can you speak kindly of the people you were a servant to? And she never answered my question. She was my first Zen teacher. No. So my grandmother was someone who only had a second grade education. She stopped going to school after she went to work as a maid. And yet she read voraciously, and she prayed a lot. And I believe she was the first monk in my life. She'd get up very early at dawn and sit in a rocking chair with her prayer books. And then after a couple hours, she'd get up and go about her business, which her whole life was about taking care of others. First her children, then her grandchildren, then the neighbor's children. So this praying she would just do. And when I was about four, five, or six, and my sister was three, four, five, we would lay in her, we would sleep with her in Cuba, and then we also slept with her in New York. I grew up in Harlem, in West Harlem. So I went from a very small town in Cuba to 125th and Broadway, right? In a flash, right? And she would pray, you know, so she started teaching us how to pray. And she'd say, you know, Our Father who are in heaven, and we repeat it. And I tell you, by the time I was sick, before I knew how to read, I could recite the deepest canon of the Roman Catholic Church, right? Without knowing it, I would just do it. So I see that for me, my practice began there, in my mother, in my grandmother's bed. And in being around her and in watching her, how she was. I didn't know anything about suffering because she did so much to protect me from it. But she knew suffering. At least I think she knew suffering. And she never caused any to anyone. And that was always a mystery to me, even before I knew anything about Zen or Buddhism. But I think what my grandmother knew was what we learn in the Dharma. I think my grandmother knew indigenous Dharma, right? Indigenous Dharma, you know, or Dhamma. And just 3 weeks ago, I was sitting where you are, and I heard a teacher who was sitting where I am say, the Buddha didn't teach Buddhism. The Buddha taught Dharma. Powerful distinction for me. So that was the gateway for me, was my grandmother watching her reciting prayers and so forth. The second layer for me of how I came to practice was that my mother wanted my sister and I to be raised Roman Catholics. In my father's family, everyone practiced spiritismo. Spiritism, and later on, Santeria. So the women on my father's lineage were all mediums. And as a child, I would be taken to the centros espirituales near our town. You know. So I grew up with that. I grew up with seeing the mediums do their thing. And we just sat there and watched. And then in New York, the same thing continued, you know. The last Sunday of each month at my apartment where I grew up, there was una misa espiritual, you know. The people came and my aunt, you know, she did her thing. She practiced her gift. Then the next piece for me was how I came to practice was that although this was the practice at home, I went to Catholic school. I went to Catholic school at, I first went to public school 125 in Harlem, then I went to Catholic school at Corpus Christi, which played a key role in Thomas Merton's life, for those of you who heard of contemplative monk. And I remember watching all those little boys wearing those robes, helping the priest with the mass, ringing bells, genuflecting, helping carrying the incense. I said, I want to do that. Right. It never occurred to me that for 2-3 years I never saw a little girl doing it, you know. But my grandmother said, you could do anything you want. You could be anything you want to be. So after a couple of years, it just, the little girls were relegated to passing out the missiles down the pews, right? And picking them up afterwards and dusting. So I was intimidated by the main priest who said the mass because he was an older guy. To me, he seemed really older. So I felt kind of, you know, I couldn't just go and ask. But then they brought this younger priest who seemed pretty cool. You know, he kind of seemed friendly to the school children. He was from Spain. He spoke Spanish. He said the Spanish mass. So I went up to him one day and I said, Padre, cuando yo crezca, yo quiero hacer lo mismo que tú. When I grew up, I want to do just like you do. I want to be just like you are, how you are. And he looked at me and he patted me on the head and he said, eso es muy dulce, pero las niñas no nacieron para hacer cura. That's very sweet, but little girls weren't born to be priests. And I never thought about it again. When I started sitting Zazen, when I came into Zen, I didn't think I was coming in with this thing about becoming a priest. I just wanted to learn how to sit Zazen. And it wasn't until just about a couple of years ago that I had an awareness, sitting in Zazen, that somehow when the priest said that to me, I didn't internalize it. And I say that because what came up for me in my Zazen was this memory of me as a child saying this to him and him patting me on the head and he saying what he said and me looking at him and thinking, he doesn't know my grandmother. It was almost like this childlike curiosity, like he must be a misinformed adult. You know, he just doesn't get it. Right? Yet, and also looking back, that was for me my first experience of sexism. You know, right there. And then I see that my last, and of course, after all these years, he was obviously wrong, you know. Let me not say wrong, he was misinformed. Because right? My first day walking through the doors of San Francisco Zen Center, and I was asked to meet with one of the teachers, white male, Irish, Paul Haller, he said, well, what brings you here? And I said, this is amazing. I just had this memory. When I was a little girl, I wanted to be a priest. And he said, oh, me too. When I was a little boy in Ireland, I also wanted to be a priest. And he went on to be a monk, you know, forest monk in Thailand. And now he's a Zen priest. So I guess one can say what a difference 30 years make. The last level that I see that brought me to practice is also what the Buddha taught as one of the, I believe it's one of the conditions of existence, which is suffering. And it was the multiple losses that I've had in my life, starting from losing my childhood, losing my childhood friends, losing my country at that age, losing my mother. And also feeling lost in a world that I would look out at the world and see such horrible things happening. And I couldn't make sense of that. I couldn't align with what my grandmother taught me, how to be in the world, to deal with what I got from the world. So the best thing I was able to do was just to think that there was something wrong with me. So my practice now began with the search for making sense of the world, for understanding the suffering. I spent the last 20-something years in the work I do in the world, understanding the suffering of others. And doing what I think I can to help that. What I hadn't clue into is that it was crucial I tune into the suffering, my suffering. And that was revolutionary. You know? Not like, yeah, I had a bad day and I suffer, you know, and I'm targeted by this and so forth. You know, from the head. But to feel my suffering in my heart and my inability to deal with that suffering and the actions I engaged in to distract me from the suffering. So how to make sense of the viciousness of racism? This unfathomable sense of loss. When one of my favorite aunts died, right? And I was just told she died. She was still in Cuba, and I remember throwing myself on the bed and just wailing. Right? Just wailing. I didn't understand why. And also. Attempting to understand this feeble attempt of controlling everything. And anybody here who ever experienced that? You know. Controlling everything. Because of my work, I spend a lot of time in airplanes and sometimes in cars. So especially when I'm in cars, I make it a habit to read bumper stickers in cars that are ahead of me. Because I believe the Dharma comes in many disguises. And this morning after breakfast, and I and I knew what my program was for this afternoon. You know, I went home to get some things, and driving up Sir Francis Drake. Sir Francis Drake. I was still with that conditioning that arose, that mind state, which is, oh my God, how could I have said yes to this? You know. I mean, I love Ralph a lot, but this is like really big, you know. It's like. But so I stopped at a red light, and in front of me was a car with this bumper sticker, too. This, the one on the right, said the piece about doing random act of kindness. Right? And the other one said, you are not inferior unless you agree to it. Something to that. It's an Eleanor Roosevelt quote. And I went, whoa. And then when I was driving back over the bridge, there was another car in front of me. And I wasn't aware that this mind state had arisen of, oh man, look at this traffic, you know. Because of course there's traffic there personally for my discomfort, you know. Can't be for any other reason, right? So then this car comes in front of me, and before I could go into like, Jesus Christ, here comes this car. The bumper, big bumper sticker, yellow background, red letters. Wonder if it was a Tibetan person. Right? It said, get a life. I swear to you, I'm not making this up. This just happened. And then when I was coming right across that turn where you kind of go through Mill Valley, or you know, it's sort of this turn, there were three white people with signs. And one of the first one said something like, "A civilized people do not engage in war." And the second one said, over 50,000 children have died in Iraq because of U.S. involvement. So how to be in the world with all its complexities is what keeps me practicing. And I was drawn to Zen by its simplicity, its austereness, and its silence. I grew up in a home and in a neighborhood where there was a lot of noise. A lot of noise. And it wasn't like I chose Zen Buddhism or this particular Zen center. I didn't know anything about that. A turning point for me was being given two books, The Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda, which I have to brag, you know, really got me because he and I share the same birthday. So I thought that was a sign. that it was okay for me to continue my revolutionary work, yet I needed to figure out how to do it differently, where I did not engage in the separation of self and others, the we, they, the me, you. That for me to be right, you got to be wrong. That for me to be smart, you have to be stupid. That for me to be good, someone else has to be bad. And the second book that began to give me a sense of, maybe there is a way to do this, was Suzuki Roshi's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And if you talk with any of Suzuki Roshi's disciples who practice with him, you'll hear that Suzuki Roshi taught by silence or through silence. He worked with his students, he had tea with his students, he lived with his students. It was through his silence. I think it's at the beginning of that book when there's an anecdote that someone asked him, how come you never talk about enlightenment? And his wife, Mitsu, said, well, that's because he's never experienced it. Something to that effect. Right. Yeah. So when I read that book and then I found out that he was the guy who founded that center, that's what brought me there. I didn't know anything, but it was, you know, I didn't even know it was Buddhism. I just knew this affinity for Zen, Suzuki Roshi, and I walked in through those doors. So let me finish with a couple stories about Suzuki Roshi. Let me begin to finish with a couple of stories of Suzuki Roshi, and then I want to read you a quote from his book. One of the sayings that my teacher, Zenkei Blanche Hartman Sensei, says was that when she first sat in front of Suzuki Roshi, she felt that he accepted her unconditionally. And when I first heard that, I was in the midst of my struggles of how could I do that, not just with other people, but with myself. And I said, "Oh, I want to learn that." It's like, want that. I'm aware there was probably some craving and desire there. You know, that's one of the poisons. But for the moment, I just took it. You know, I'll own it. So there is a famous quote of Suzuki Roshi where he says that we are all perfect just the way we are. We just need a little improvement. That's what he says. I didn't say that, he said that. Yeah. We are all perfect just the way we are. Just need a little improvement. And the other story is that I believe he was teaching at Tassajara Monastery. And, you know, people have been sitting for a long time and their legs hurt. And, you know, but in Zen, you sit even if your legs fall off, you know. Now, let me not scare you away. In Zen, you learn to work with your pain. And he said something like, you know all these difficulties you're now having? Your life is challenging, all these struggles. And the people who were there said that they all sat up, right? Because it's like they thought, here comes the teaching that's just going to... And he said, they'll be with you for the rest of your life. So let me finish, because I want to give some time for questions, and I apologize, I went over what I had planned. He says, when we practice Zazen, which is the essence of Zen meditation, our mind is calm and quite simple. But usually our mind is very busy and complicated, and it is difficult to be concentrated on what we're doing. This is because before we act, we think, and this thinking leaves some trace. Our activity is overshadowed by some preconceived idea. The thinking not only leaves some trace or shadow, but also gives us many other notions about other activities and things. These traces and notions make our minds very complicated. When we do something with a quiet, simple, clear mind, we have no notion or shadows, and our activity is strong and straightforward. But when we do something with a complicated mind, in relation to other things, or people, or society, our activity becomes very complex. In order not to leave any traces, when you do something, you should do it with your whole body and mind. You should be concentrated on what you do. You should do it completely, like a good bonfire. You should not be a smoky fire. You should burn yourself completely. If you do not burn yourself completely, a trace of yourself will be left in what you do. If you do not burn yourself completely, a trace of yourself will be left in what you do. You will have something remaining which is not completely burned out. Zen activity is activity which is completely burned out with nothing remaining but ashes. This is the goal of our practice. That is what Dogen meant. Dogen was the founder of the Soto school, which is one of the Zen school that remains. This is what Dogen meant when he said, ashes do not come back to firewood. Ash is ash. Ash should be completely ash. The firewood should be firewood. When this kind of activity takes place, one activity covers everything. So our practice is not a matter of 1 hour or 2 hours or 1 day or 1 year. If you practice Zazen with your whole body and mind, even for a moment, that is Zazen. So moment after moment, you should devote yourself to your practice. Thank you for listening to the Dharma. We have a little time for questions. We have a little time for answers. Or we can just sit. Yes.
Something very special is happening on September 8th.
You want me to say something about that? Who said that? Joy girl. Okay. See, you've got to understand, I love to talk about myself. So this practice, it's really a struggle for me, right? On September 8th, what Ralph is alluding to is I'll be receiving priest ordination from my teacher at the San Francisco Zen Center. And wholeheartedly, all of you are invited. Because in my practice, in the Mahayana Buddhism and the Bodhisattva vow, our practice is not for us. We practice for others. And that's how we develop compassion. That's our, the Bodhisattva is she or he who keeps coming back. So that's happening on September 8th at 4 p.m. at San Francisco Zen Center. 300 Page Street at Laguna. And it means a lot because the date is the in the Yoruba tradition in Cuba, September 8th is the Feast of Oshun. Right? It's a very it's one of the most significant spiritual date in Cuban culture, the syncretism with La Caridad del Cobre, Our Lady of Copper. I had nothing to do with choosing that date. Yes, please. The question is, what's your name?
Gloria.
Gloria's question is whether after I become a priest, my work will be doing other work or will it be priest work? In my situation, it's an I don't know. Because my practice has been a householder. I've done monastic training at Tassajara. I'll be going back there again, but mainly I've been a lay householder. So it's unusual to then take these priest vows. My teacher is not requiring me to move in monastically because her sense is the work I do in the world is right livelihood. Right? And that work is about, I do anti-oppression work. Right? And I'm a mediator, so I do conflict resolution. So sort of, however, part of my training would be to learn more of the forms, the services, yes, and be available, be a service. Yes?
I don't know too much about Zen, but it's something that you hear a lot about. Like when I was growing up, it was I get the sense that it was misused as all Zen is Zen that. So I know that there's a lot of misconceptions about what it is and what it isn't, and what it is ever. And but one thing that I keep thinking about is this notion that I have that is somehow related to it. That there's a relationship between humor and the Zen. And I've been wondering about this for a long time because I'm like a closet Zen comedian.
say the last thing again, I didn't hear you.
I'm like a closet stand-up comedian, you know, like in my spare time. And so I wondered if
if you start sitting zazen, in 30 years you could become a Zen master. And I'm not saying that lightly. In Zen, what I've learned is that it takes 10 years to become a student, 20 years to become a teacher. So even here, I'm talking to you as a Dharma friend, and 30 years to become a master. And the humor that you bring, that's your essence. And that essence is what just flowers in Zen practice. And when I asked once, well, what is Zazen? You know, what is Zen? I was told Zen is being all of who you are. And when I practiced in Japan last year, it was my first time. It was a different experience than when I practiced at San Francisco Zen Center around that humor issue. Right. So when you see Zen monks, I know Japanese monks, that's my experience. It's a lot of joy and humor. Right? So it's important to see with clear comprehension what is the practice. What is the essence of a practice and a tradition? And not confuse it when it's filtered with other things. One and two. Yes.
How did you actually decide on Zen? And did you check, did you investigate or try out other traditions and then decide on this one, or did you just notice it?
I just, there was sort of this affinity. And it might have been from what the young brother just said about, you know, Zen was in the culture. You know, it's become very Zen and the art of motorcycle, whatever, and, you know, kind of thing. So I went to Zazen instruction. Right? And the man who gave my instruction actually is my teacher's husband, Lou Hartman. He's in his late 80s. And he taught us how to sit. Right? He taught us how to hold our body. Legs, hands, and he said two things. The first thing he said, there you go, that's all you need to learn how to sit Zazen. It takes 15, 20 minutes to learn the posture. He said, but it takes a lifetime to practice it. And that grabbed me. And the second thing he said was that somebody raised their hand and said, how come you do all this bowing, you know? You bow when you come in, you bow when you sit down, you bow when you look at your cushion. It's like, what is this bowing, you know? And he said, in this country, we need to learn how to bow. And I don't know why that got me. So I didn't explore anything else. So once you learn how to sit Zazen, which is the sitting meditation, I walked into that Zendo and I felt I was home. Second only to sitting right here with you.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Yeah. So, yes. Yes. Good, good, good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The question is there a daily practice or do you have to go into a Zen center? Oh, I realized I didn't repeat your question. But did everyone hear sister's question? Yeah. There is a daily practice. Every day, my teacher says for her, being a Zen priest means you sit Zazen every day. So you, there's a schedule that you, if you go to Zen, there's a schedule when there's group meditation. Or you could do it at home, right, the meditation. And then in the Soto school, there's ritual, right? And I love ritual. Right? That's, you know, I love ritual, and I love the, it's the Catholic thing, you know. The, no, you know. And also when I seen when I seen photos of, you know, our African elders, you know, wearing the robes and the, it's there. So in the Soto school, there's a service. So if you were to go to the Zen Center in the morning, there's 2 periods of meditation with a 10-minute walking in between, and then a service, like a 20-25-minute service of chanting in Japanese and English. Yeah. And then there's also sitting at the end of the in the evening. So yes, you, definitely it's a daily practice. And you can do it at home. The long extended sittings is difficult to do alone. It's hard to do alone. That's where sangha or community comes in. You know, with other people, you could sit 14 hours a day for 7 days, which is the Rohatsu, 12, 14 hours. The Rohatsu Sesshin is a 7-day meditation Sesshin that happens the first week in December to commemorate Buddha's enlightenment. And you sit from morning till night, you know, with a few breaks. That's very hard to do alone. For me, that would be very hard to do alone. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.